So now please stay in your seats and we'll look together at the first paragraph or so of Great Master Dogen's Genjo Koan, which is variously translated as a title. I think the one that I like best is Actualization of Reality, which may sound a bit more obscure than it really is. I'll get on to that. So first of all, the disclaimer. The Genjo Koan is a beautiful, short text, but it's got a lot of facets and dimensions to it. And it repays detailed study. And there's no way that even in a series of a dozen or so teisho, we're going to scrape the full bottom of it. So this is just me throwing out some thoughts and directions and ideas that you might choose to pursue in your own study. Or alternatively, just let the words wash over you. That's to say, Dogen's words, not mine. And just enjoy the poetry and the feel of it. We live here in what's in a posh description called a townhouse, which means basically that the ground floor is mostly garage. And the living accommodation is on the first floor. And our kitchen overlooks the back garden, in which we have bird feeders. And often I'll be making coffee or something like that, and just out of the corner of my eye, because I'm at right angles to the window, I'll get a fleeting glimpse of something. And it could be that the wind has just caught a little branch of the honeysuckle, which has flapped, and it means nothing. Or it could mean that I've just seen a goldfinch that's landing on the feeders. And it's not until you turn around and look that you find out which of those it is. But I often get that feeling when I'm reading the Genjo Koan of something just happening out of the corner of my eye, something I almost understand, but don't quite. And that's actually rather a lovely feeling, and it leaves more to be investigated. But I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think there's a simple analytical way of, quotes, understanding what Dogen Zenji meant by the Genjo Koan, which is why I say maybe it's enough just to let the words wash over you and enjoy them. So I'm going to read the first paragraph. When all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings. When the 10,000 dharmas are without fixed self, there is no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no living beings, no birth and no death. Since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond the dichotomy of abundance and deficiency, there is arising and perishing, delusion and realization, living beings and Buddhas. Therefore, flowers fall even though we love them. Weeds grow even though we dislike them. And at first glance, this paragraph, these four sentences, contain the most massive contradictions. One minute he says this, the next minute he seems to dispute it completely. And it's a little bit hard to take in directly with the brain, but bear with me a moment, because I think that some of this is a bit more straightforwardly understandable than it might seem. If you've been following this series, you'll know that Dogen began his training at the age of about 14. As a Tendai monk, and it wasn't till rather later that he decamped and went to study Zen at Keninji. And even here, because of the powerful influence of Tendai in Kyoto, the capital, even here, Keninji didn't teach pure Zen. It also taught Tendai. The Tendai was the base for everything at that time. So where does Tendai come from? 100 years before Bodhidharma arrives in China, in the 6th century, the Tendai monk Ziyi, Z-H-I-Y-I, was carrying out an enormous analysis of the teachings of Buddhism. Buddhism had arrived in sutra form in China hundreds of years before Bodhidharma came. And the main approach to it at that time was scholastic. Let's get in amongst the words, let's understand the teaching. Ziyi tried to produce a kind of compendium of understanding of what the Buddha's teachings were. And to do that, he went back to the original teachings of the Buddha, 2,000 years or so before. He also went back to the teachings of Nagarjuna, who was, if you like, one of the fathers of the Mahayana school. And he attempted to assemble all these bits in the light of the teaching of the Lotus Sutra, which says there is only one vehicle. And I think he saw his job, well, this is my take on it, as attempting to assemble a comprehensive and intelligible version that included everything. And he came up with a formula, a way of stating what the truth was. And the formula was affirmation, negation, a kind of synthesis. So the first paragraph here, when all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice, life and death, Buddhas and living beings, invites us to think perhaps about the Theravada teachings, the detailed analytical teachings about the step-by-step progress within the training towards enlightenment that composed quite a lot of the Buddha's own teachings. And then you might map the second paragraph. When the 10,000 dharmas are without fixed self, there is no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no living beings, no birth and no death, which seems like a denial of the first short sentence. You might map that onto Nagarjuna's view of Buddhism, which is to deny everything, to negate everything. Nagarjuna didn't put forward a positive statement. He simply demolished everybody else's and proved that they couldn't possibly be right. So there you have a paragraph or a section that says yes and a section that says no. Ziyi's insight is actually that although on the surface these two things seem to be in direct opposition, these two statements seem to be pure contradiction, when you approach from the point of view of the middle way of practice, this isn't so. The middle way encompasses the first and the second. The middle way says they both mean the same thing. Perhaps in practice, or perhaps without the words, in practice. But what's significant here is that in the third statement of Dogen Zenji's Genjo Koan, we move from talking about the Buddha Dharma and the Dharma to talking about the Buddha way. And suddenly we're in the realm of genuine practice, of what do we do about this. And he says, the Buddha way by nature goes beyond the dichotomy of abundance and deficiency, of having and not having, of yes and no, of the opposites, in other words. You'll remember the many Zen teachings that say when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. And here what we're being pointed to is the fact that in the realm of our practice, when we sit Zazen, for example, we don't get lost in the words of the Theravada version, and we don't get lost in the emptiness of the Mahayana version. We sit somewhere with both apparently contradictory views, quite happily not in our mind, because we're not brooding over them. They're just in the background, if you like. And Dogen often uses this Ziyi analysis. You'll find it throughout Shobo Genzo in a number of different places, where he uses this yes, no, combined. But then he takes a fourth step. Now, Ziyi's fourth step was to define something called the perfect truth, which encompasses all the others, which is another philosophical concept, and by its own nature kind of defeats itself, because what it says is you can't analyze reality with words, and then it goes on to say, but here's what another set of words will tell you. So in a sense, Ziyi's final formulation has always seemed to me to be a bit of a nonsense. It's a bit unkind, but there you go. What Dogen does is to plunge us straight out of these philosophical discussions and debates and theories into practicality, into our daily life. And in our daily life, good heavens, flowers fall even though we love them, and weeds grow even though we dislike them. The things we want to do that are good somehow never last, and always our karmic stream throws up something in the way of a weed in the future. I think the analogy I'm going to draw here for this apparently contradictory set of statements is a dog. You could read a manual about a dog and you could be told how they need to be fed and all sorts of other things. And that would be the positive statement about the dog. Or you could have another view of the dog in which you realize that actually it's very difficult to distinguish between a dog and a horse. You know, they've both got ears and a tail. They've got this vaguely similar shaped mouth. They've got four legs. So if you were a Martian arriving on our planet, you'd have a bit of difficulty, maybe, distinguishing between a large dog and a Shetland pony. You might say, well, I can't see what, how is it these are different? So Dogen says, put your hand on the dog, touch the dog, stroke the dog, and the dog, of course, comes alive under your hand. And I think that's what Dogen is doing here. He's moving us from the dry analysis of philosophy and the fiddling around with words into putting our hand on the dog of life, feeling its vital, throbbing nature. Just feel the dog. And of course, this is the world of impermanence, and flowers fall even though we love them, and weeds grow even though we dislike them. So there is nothing we can hang on to in perpetuity. All we can do is keep on putting our hand back on the dog and feeling its life and living through that touch. Well, that may help or it may not. But what I'm striving to do is to say, even though on the face of it, the first four sentences of the Shobo Genjo Koan seem to be a bit screwy and difficult to get your head round, when you look at it in terms of the different perspectives that Dogen is drawing on, and if you arrive at his final destination of touching the reality of existence, I think that's what he's trying to point us at. I'll stop there for today. Please stay in your seats and in the Zazen posture if possible. I'm now going to pick up again Great Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo Genjo Koan, which is sometimes called actualizing the fundamental point or actualization of reality, and which I would like to see as meditation in action in daily life, how our life is if we come from Zazen. And again, I need to do the disclaimer, a little bit like the television adverts. This is a provisional understanding that I'm sharing with you. I don't claim it's definitive, and I think anybody who says they fully understand what Dogen meant several hundred years ago, writing in an arcane form of the equivalent of Chaucerian English, they're braver than I am. So last week we looked at his early statement, his statements about the Buddha Dharma and how they relate to the Buddha Way, which ends, therefore flowers fall even though we love them, weeds grow even though we dislike them. He goes on to say, conveying oneself towards all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are ordinary living beings. Furthermore, there are those who attain realization beyond realization, and those who are deluded within delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas, and they continue actualizing Buddha. the first and very important thing to bring out of this is that although Dogen talks of concrete things, Buddhas and, by contrast, living beings, realization and, by contrast, delusion, he's not talking about permanent states. He's not talking about a binary condition where, until today, I was an ordinary living being, but now I'm enlightened and forever onwards I'm a Buddha. He's talking about how we flip back and forth between these two conditions, the condition of wisdom and compassion and the condition of the three poisons of greed, anger and delusion, on a day-to-day basis, on a minute-to-minute, on a moment-to-moment basis. We are one or the other. We are a blend always of both. And in the same way that he talks about practice and enlightenment as a twin statement, because we're practicing, we exhibit enlightenment, if you want to see it very crudely. Because he talks about practice enlightenment, we almost need to think of Buddha-ly living being as a single description of our permanent state. So, conveying oneself towards all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. When we have a grand plan, when we first learn about Buddhism, when we think, I'll do this for 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, whatever, I'll become enlightened. We have a theory about what enlightenment is. We have a theory about how our progress should look. And all the time we have a theory, we're wrong. Dogen says we're enlightened from the first. You don't have to step by step become enlightened. Dogen says the moment you sit down on your black cushion, you are exhibiting, you are being enlightened. So the first sentence I take to mean that as soon as we have a theory, an idea of what our training should be, we've distanced ourselves. When, on the other hand, things come to us, when everything appears to us, when we haven't got our self in the way, we can act in an enlightened way. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. This is seeing things as they are, not imposing our mental map on them. We are actualizing Buddha, seeing things as they are, being with things as they are. As Shunryu Suzuki loved to say, things as it is, a sort of ungrammatical statement, but draws us to the as it is condition, the way the world is right now, reality as we face it. Dogen goes on, those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas, those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. Furthermore, there are those who attain realization beyond realization, and those who are deluded within delusion. If you did management training in the 1980s, you will have come across something called the Johari window, an idea put up by a couple of guys whose names were Joe something and Harrison something, I think, which was that you can divide things into something like the panes of a window, an old-fashioned sash window that has four panes, two at the top and two at the bottom. And you can draw on those axes things that are known and things that are not known. And they talk about the top left-hand corner being the things that you know. That's straightforward. The top right-hand corner is the things that you don't know. So that's okay too, because you've got a handle on those things, even though you know your limitations. The bottom left-hand corner is things that you don't know you know. Those funny moments when something comes to you and you think, oh, I didn't realize I understood that. But then the dangerous bottom right-hand corner, things that we don't know. The unknown, unknown. And this business of dividing the world into these positive and negative four-way things runs throughout Buddhism like a river. it was brought to perfection by Nagarjuna in something called the Katushkoti. And it's something that the Buddha often spoke about. When people ask him tough questions, questions to which there really was no answer, he had a way of saying, I'm not going to engage with that question. And it ran like this. If somebody asked, did the world have a beginning? Does the world have a beginning? The answer was fourfold. Number one, no, the world does not have a beginning. Number two, it does not fail to have a beginning. Number three, it doesn't have and not have a beginning, both conditions. And the fourth one, nor does it neither have nor not have a beginning. And this denial, which sounds illogical, because how can something both have and not have, or both not have and have? This is not really a philosophical statement of a positive sort. It's simply a refusal to engage because the words don't work, because it's impossible to fathom it, and there are better things to do with your time. And in this same way, we've got this pattern of four affirmations or denials in this paragraph about delusion and realization. And in a way, all that's happening here, I believe, is that we're being shown that the words are inadequate to the reality that we sit down and see quite plainly before us every time we're on our black cushion looking at the wall. Dogen goes on to say, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas, and they continue actualizing Buddha. And my first teacher used to say, sometimes I raise the eyebrows of old Shakyamuni and wink, and sometimes I do not. But she went on to say, I never know whether I'm raising his eyebrows, but I sure as hell know when I'm not. So, in a negative sense, we can understand when we've fallen off the wagon, when we've slipped into the long grass, when we've made a mistake, when we've upset people, when we've done something foolish, when we've taken ourselves too seriously. We can easily understand when we're not Buddha. And in a sense, for many of us, the issue is allowing for the fact that at times we are Buddha. We do act in such a way as to bring the truth into the world, as to work with reality as it truly is. He goes on, in seeing colour and hearing sound with full body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or the moon in water. When one side is illuminated, the other is dark. There are poetic images in here which can help us a little bit with trying to get a handle on these rather obscure statements. Darkness is regarded as how do I say this carefully? In the Sandokai, we hear, within all light is darkness. So light contains darkness, and darkness contains light. And darkness is a metaphor for the enlightened condition. It seems counterintuitive, but there you go. And the other thing to say is that the moon in Dogen's writing is very often an image of enlightenment. So in trying to unpack what this short section means, I think we can look at it in two contrasting ways. One is to say, when we fully experience the world through seeing and through hearing, there is nothing left over. And this is not like subject and object, where we step back and we see the reflection in the mirror, where we step back and we see the moon shining in the lake. This is seeing directly, seeing completely. And yet, when one side is illuminated, the other is dark. Though we see clearly, true enlightenment, the true depth of being Buddha, is not something that we conceive in our brains, is not something that we handle in our brains. I have to leave you to wrestle with that part on your own. If you read the commentaries, they all contradict one another rather marvellously. My take is, we're being asked to engage with life fully and have no molecule, no atom left over, and therefore not expect to be able to judge the quality of what we're doing in the moment. Sometimes I raise the eyebrows of old Shakyamuni and wink, and sometimes I do not. I'll end there for today. Please now stay in your seats and we'll consider together the section of Great Master Dogen's Genjo Koan. And the usual disclaimer, these are my views and you must make of them what you will. So this is the very well-known section that says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. There is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. When one first seeks the Dharma, one strays far from the boundary of the Dharma. When the Dharma is correctly transmitted to the self, one is immediately an original person. So in the earlier sections, Dogen has been pointing out paradoxes, if you like, about the way that we study Buddhism, that simultaneously we are deluded and enlightened by turns throughout our time. And now he comes, if you like, to the practical application of that. We live in a society which is largely driven by fame and gain. The things that we value are our jobs, our prestige, our income, our possessions. And as a society, that's the center that we live from. Dogen is inviting us to do here is to live from a different place, for a different purpose. He's, if you like, implicitly asking us the question, what are your drivers? What are the things that make you tick? What is your life's meaning? And we can only answer those questions by turning inward, by examining ourselves. Quite a few people don't last very long with Zen Buddhism. They give it a go, hoping for some instant achievement, some accomplishment, and they're disappointed. Because their yardstick is all wrong, because their way of understanding what they're trying to do is all wrong, and because they're working from the head. And the head is good for many, many things, but it's not very good for helping us with the spiritual life. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. In a sense, this is quite a revolutionary statement, because we think that religion is about outward forms, and here we're being pushed in the opposite direction. And the tragedy, of course, is we can't like what we see when we look inside. Superficially, we're all the best person in the world. Everything else is wrong, but we're fine. And when we stop and turn inward, we find it's a little harder to keep believing that. The more we examine ourselves, the more critical we become. But it's important to remember that this is not some sort of reprogramming going on, some sort of challenge. This is a gentle erosion of the things that we don't admire about ourselves, which is carried out through the practice of Zazen. Simply sitting and being, we see aspects of ourselves that we no longer wish to put up with. And without any revolution, we quietly work away from those, consciously and unconsciously. And that inversion is what brings us to the second sentence. To study the self is to forget the self. No longer quite so important. no longer quite so puffed up, no longer quite so determined that everything will center on us. We begin to see our connection to the wider world. We begin to understand that we're not alone, that we're interconnected with everything. Dogen goes on to say, to forget the self is to be verified by all things. Some translations, Robert Aitkins of the Honolulu Diamond Sangha, for example, some translations say, to forget the self is to be enlightened. Here, this translation refers to the fact that everywhere we look around us, we find things that reinforce a better understanding of how we fit into the universe. It's spring now, and if you go for a walk in the country, you'll see trees and bushes and shrubs in the hedgerows, in all their glory, beginning to form the first leaves and the first flowers of the new season. And we begin to connect, the closer we look, with this concept, this recognition of the circle of our lives. We begin to look in more detail at what makes us up as human beings. The mere movement of the hand to grasp is a miracle. If you stop and consider how hard it is to reproduce that mechanically, and how then a mechanical hand has no sensation. When you consider the vast number of tendons and ligaments and muscles and bones in the hand, how they all fit together, how they've all evolved across time, it is a truly amazing thing. And yet we use it without thinking about it throughout our day. The more closely we look at what we are, both body and mind, the more we understand, the more we let go, the more we're able to express our innate Buddha nature. I never know how to say Thich Nhat Hanh's name. It always seems to me to be difficult. I'm sure I've mispronounced it. He has a lovely section in his commentary, I think it's on the Heart Sutra, where he points out that a single sheet of paper contains the sun, contains the lumberjack who cut down the tree, contains the meal that the lumberjack had before he cut down the tree, that everything is connected to everything, that our breathing goes beyond our boundary, that the food that we take, one moment it's outside us, it's an object, the next moment it's part of us. The whole idea of where our boundaries end gets thrown away when you start to look at the world from this perspective. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. So we reduce this distinction that always puts us at the center of the universe, and we understand that we too will pass away in our time. And the most important thing that we can do in our lives is to make sure that we don't leave too much rubbish behind us, that we haven't messed up, that we haven't ruined life for other people, that we haven't done things that are inappropriate. And so the act of turning in, of shining our light inside, liberates us from our not-so-good self. Dogen goes on, there's a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. We are never away from it. Even when we are at our lowest, there within us all is our innate Buddha nature. And this echoes something that he said a little earlier, which is, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't perceive they are Buddhas. We don't have to know. We simply have to continue with our practice. When one first seeks the Dharma, one strays far from the boundary of the Dharma. This is about trying too hard, about believing that there is something out there to get. Written on the back of my rakusu is the lovely advice from the Shinjin Mei. Do not seek the truth. Simply abandon false views. We're not trying to get anything. trying to let go, to sense what's already there within us. When the Dharma is correctly transmitted to the self, one is immediately an original person. No number of rules and regulations would be enough to make this happen, but our openness, our unfetteredness, our willingness to see the world as it really is everything. When we give the world our attention, we are awake, we are enlightened. There is no more to find. On Sunday, Maitre Guy's Kusen ended with the story of Kyogen and Isan. Isan was his master. And Isan asked Kyogen, this is my very compressed summary, but you can read the full Kusen on the ezork.org website. Isan challenged Kyogen, who was very scholarly, erudite and well-informed, and said, tell me in a word, what was your original face before your parents were born? And Kyogen wrestled with this for years and then begged his master, please tell me the word. I don't understand, nothing I can do helps me. Please tell me the word. And Isan says, if I were to tell you, I fear you would hold it against me. That's a very telling statement. We can't really tell one another anything. But more to the point, it is our own seeking that contains our own truth. We can't get this intravenously. We can't get it from books. We can only get it from practice, from the gentle erosion of the things we no longer wish to have, and from finding the light that we seek for ourselves. So it's a kindness to refuse to answer the question. Of course, it took years for Kyogen to understand that. And when he did, he said that he owed Isan more reverence than he owed to his own parents. So please stay in your seat. And I'll begin the Teisho. So we're on the paragraph from the Genjo Koan. If one riding in a boat watches the coast, one mistakenly perceives the coast as moving. If one watches the boat in relation to the surface of the water, then one notices that it's the boat that's moving. Similarly, when we perceive the body and mind in a confused way and grasp all things with a discriminating mind, we mistakenly think that the self-nature of the mind is permanent. When we intimately practice, that is to say, closely study our own being, when we intimately practice and return right here to live in the present moment exactly, it's clear that all things have no fixed self. One of the things that happened at the birth of the Mahayana around 0 AD or thereabouts, the first century, was a major argument about the Buddha's original statement that there was no essence, no continuing entity, no soul in a human being. And a series of philosophical debates had begun in the period running up to the end of the BC era, where people had begun to imbue Buddhist thinking with the idea of something that more or less did amount to a fixed self. And so Nagarjuna took up the cudgels in his arguments and spent a lot of time demonstrating logically that this was not possible. And he summarized his thinking by saying, if we had a fixed self, change would, by definition, be impossible. And yet, all around we see only change. Only because the self is not fixed is impermanence possible. And it takes a little bit of getting your head around, but the fundamental point that he's making is that the nature of our lives is impermanent. We live through this, we see this, and nowhere can we point to permanence at all. And that all our problems hang from our belief in a permanent self. This is Dogen's point. It's a fundamental error from which all the other errors hang. We must examine this very closely from our own experience, even to begin to understand how this sets us free. So as a prelude to the next section on firewood, which has always been one of my favourite mental tussles, I want to take you back to the days of cinema when 24 frames a second, as the 35mm film ran through the gate of the projector, was enough to make us believe that things were continuous. If a series of discrete photographs are played fast enough, then it feels like flowing motion. But Nagarjuna and Dogen say, if you like, this is the trick which the universe plays on us. Because our brains are a bit slow to catch up, we don't see the sleight of hand going on between the changes. Dogen actually says in the Shuke Kudoku, the merit of home leaving, becoming a monk or a nun, a human body is born and perishes moment by moment without ceasing. It is born and perishes at each of the 65 moments contained with one snap of the fingers, but because of our ignorance, we don't notice it. And he then goes on to produce a calculation which I've been unable to reproduce, in which he says there are 6,400,099,980 moments in a day. Each of them separate is the point. So when we come to look at the next section, we need to bear in mind this view of Dogen's. The next section reads, firewood becomes ash. Ash cannot become firewood again. However, we should not view ash as after and firewood as before. We should know that firewood dwells in the Dharma position of firewood and has its own before and after. Although before and after exist, past and future are cut off. Ash stays in the position of ash, with its own before and after. Which I think is another way of saying what I just said about 24 frames a second. Life is a series of stills, not a continuous movie. And this binds together quite nicely with, as one of the study group members pointed out, with string theory and quantum theory as we see it now, which scientists are grappling with to this day in a very exciting way. A way that is very hard for us to operationalise, but I think it helps us to understand that Dogen, 800 years ago, seemed to have an intuitive grasp of something that scientists are really wrestling with to this day. So firewood becomes ash, it's an irreversible position, but in a way the word becomes is wrong. As firewood never becomes firewood again after it has been burned to ash, there is no return to living after a person dies. However, in Buddha Dharma, it is an unchanged tradition not to say that life becomes death. Therefore, we call it no arising. And it is the established way of Buddha's turning of the Dharma wheel not to say that death becomes life. Therefore, we call it no perishing. Life is a position in time. Death is also a position in time. This is like winter and spring. We don't think that winter becomes spring, and we don't say that spring becomes summer. But this word becomes turns out to be pivotal here, because what Dogen is saying is if each of these things is cut off, they don't change into one another. We had some discussion in the study group about, yes, spring follows winter, but it isn't winter turning into spring. There's no transmigration, as it were. And he's using this in a way to explore the whole question of being born and dying, of birth and no birth, of death and no death, which of course is echoed. We echo it every time that we chant the Hanya Shingyo. There is no life, there is no death, there is no becoming, there's no going away. So it's very hard to talk about this with ordinary words, because you fall over your own linguistic feet all the time. Even here we get firewood becomes ash, ash cannot become firewood again, and then later on Dogen denies the word become and says actually firewood doesn't become anything, it's just firewood, and then later there's ash. These things are separate. It's very hard for us to understand this because we tend to see time as flowing. Either, apparently there are two ways of seeing this, either we're standing still and time is flowing towards us, or the river of time is, as it were, stationary and we are flowing through it. These are our common-sensed ways of seeing life, and we talk about when I was a child, we talk about when I retire, or when I retired, and we see all of these things as points on a map in a kind of continuous movement through life. And yet, when you really stop and examine it, when you really sit right here on your black cushion, there is no past that's separate from the present. Everything we think we know about the past is contained in this very moment here. And everything we fret about in the future is not present. It only is present in the sense that we are holding a concept of the future in our heads. So operationalizing this, Dogen is pushing us towards a deeper and deeper and deeper study of what we are now, because right now we are life. It may be later that we will be death, but right now we are life. We can't point to a beginning. We can't point to an end. We didn't really, psychologists might want to argue about this with me, but we don't now have an experience of our birth. And when we come to die, we won't really directly have an experience of that because we will cease at that point. Now, there's a lot of discussion about birth and rebirth and reincarnation, which I think the Buddha always ducked. He refused to say what happens after death, because we can't contemplate it. It's a meaningless discussion, although religions tend to dwell on it quite significantly. So I'm going to end by restating what Dogen says in Shuke Kudoku. A human body is born and perishes moment by moment without ceasing. It is born and perishes at each of the 65 moments contained with one snap of the fingers. But because of ignorance, we don't notice it. When she was allowed to call her book what she wanted to call it, as opposed to what the publisher called it, Jiyūkennet Roshi called her book, which had previously been called Selling Water by the River, she retitled it Zen is Eternal Life, which feels like a very bold claim. And yet I think it's what Dogen is saying. If we live our lives moment by moment, if we truly immerse ourselves in the fine detail of where we are now, there is no beginning and there is no end. There is only this precious moment which deserves all of our attention, because this is the only place that we can be, the only place that we can act. And all future karma, if we're allowed such a thing after the discussion we've just been having, all future karma depends on this moment now. If we make a mistake with it, if we do it wrongly or inattentively, if we later live to regret it, we've thrown away the chance to operate well at this moment. And the reason that the precepts are so important is that they guide what we do in this moment. Cease from evil. Do only good. Do what is good for others. Thank you for listening. I'll stop there.